This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Coming up on this week's show, a Commodore 64 replica for less than the price of a game.
A heartwarming story from Nintendo.
And we take our first look at Command & Conquer Remastered.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 217, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And welcome to this week's show. Now, actually, I was quite pleased looking at the stats that we've actually had some quite healthy numbers over the last couple of weeks. I think a lot of people at the moment are discovering new podcasts.
Yeah, it could be due to recent events in the news and stuff like that. Could be a couple of people staying at home, a couple of people working from home. But it's really awesome. And either way, whatever the reason that you've come here, we really, really appreciate it.
Now, I did get actually a little Facebook message the other day. Some guy going, I'm listening to my Alexa. And he figured out that you can just say, you know, Alexa, play the Retro Hour podcast, and it plays it, which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you are at home and you've got a smart speaker nearby, really good way to listen. And if you are a new listener as well, let's just give you a very nice welcome to the show. I'm Dan. Ravi and Joe's here as well. We've done this podcast for 4 years now. So over 4 years, actually. Every single Friday we bring out a podcast, and we bring you a guest on the show every week. Now, sometimes people say, well, seriously, you have a guest in every episode?
Yeah,
every week.
For that long, and we've not missed an episode as well. We've had a few where we've done, like, Q&As, or we've talked about, like, we always do a super quiz at Christmas stuff, but we always bring you a quality guest.
And also a massive shout out to Ravi, because he always sources these guests.
Yep.
And sometimes it gets a bit like, you know, white knuckle, a bit like biting nails.
You know,
but, you know, 4 years in, we're in our fifth year now, and it's still, the quality's there, man. It's not like, oh, here's Trev from your local shop who once had a PlayStation. Hey,
don't diss like, Trev, he might be next week.
He might be next week, you never know. But they're always amazing guests, you know. Well, at least I like to think, you know, not being very humble here, but they're always amazing guests.
I'll cancel Trev for next week.
But it's true, though, the amount of times we get tweets from people going, just when I thought the Retro had run out of getting guests, you get Charlie Brooker on or something like that.
You know? And do you know what? We've got a list, a huge list of about 200 people that I want to get on for the future. So this isn't going to stop.
No, absolutely. And Ravi works very hard to get the guests on, and they're always fantastic as well. Now, we cover a load of different systems as well. I mean, Joe, you're really into console gaming. Ravi's really like the PC guy among us. And I'm kind of, you know, I don't have a clue, really. I've got no idea about retro games. I just come in, what are retro games? But I mean, we've all kind of got our own little areas of gaming that we're into. But we like to cover quite a lot in this show. I mean, the Commodore 64 is always a system that I really enjoy covering as well. And this week, we're going to be joined by a C64 legend. Now, Carlton Handley, he worked for so many different companies back in the day, and he's, you know, I think of the games he worked on, especially football games. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, so he was working during that kind of FIFA period after Sensi and Kickoff. So we talk a bit about football, but also we talk about Spitting Image, which was one of those huge titles. And we also talk about maybe a new project that he's working on, because he's actually gone back into C64 development. So, you know, the C64 scene's blowing up, and as we'd noticed with a lot of these programmers, they're actually going full circle and returning back to their roots.
It's crazy, because, I mean, he actually worked for a company called Walking Circles. That actually, I remember reading quite a bit about Walking Circles, one of their most famous titles. They did a version of Hunt for Red October back in the day. I think they went out of business like 91, 92. But they had quite a good run of it, a British gaming company, one that you don't hear much of anymore. Mm. And I was actually quite interested to talk to him.
It's with Domark as well, wasn't
it? Yeah, a lot of the games were released through Domark, and, you know, games that came out with EA and Atari and stuff as well. So it's a really interesting chat, this, about, you know, a really good time in British gaming. And one interesting point that you mentioned there is that he's now back into making games again for the Commodore 64. He's gone through all the consoles. He did iOS games for like a decade. Now he actually said the games he's bringing out on the 64 are not only getting more attention than all the phone games he's done for the last decade, but also actually getting more attention than the games he released in the 64 when it was new.
And making more money than the iOS ones. Oh, wow. Which is crazy.
That is crazy.
That is amazing. So, well, yeah, Colton Handley, he's going to be our guest on the show in around 20 minutes from now. Now, every week on the podcast as well, we update you with what's been happening in the world of retro gaming. So that's one thing, I mean, you know, kind of tying into what we said there about the fact that these games are doing really well. The retro gaming scene is thriving. I mean, there are weeks where literally we can't fit all the news stories into like an hour long episode. It's like there's always stuff happening. That's one thing I always find when journalists interview us are like, well, what news is going on in retro? Isn't it all old stuff you're talking about? It's like, no, there's new stuff.
Yeah, whenever I kind of like let it slip at work that I'm actually a super nerd and I say to somebody,
everyone knows,
you know, I do a podcast or whatever about retro game news, and they're just like, what do you mean, like retro games? You must run out of stuff to talk about. And I'm like, you would not believe the stuff that's still happening. Do you know what I mean? It's crazy the amount of things that just like pop up out of nowhere, like Nintendo PlayStations and stuff like that. It's crazy.
Well, even in like, since we started doing the show, it's like we have more news than ever every week to get through now. And more of our favourite games are coming back as well. Now, we did an episode, God, must have been like 2 years ago maybe now, with Frank Kaplacki.
Yes.
And Ravi was well excited about that one.
And we also did one with Louis Castle kind of head of Westwood.
Yeah.
And Westwood Studios, they were the king of real-time strategy, and they did a Command and Conquer, and he was telling us about a little thing called the Command and Conquer Remastered Collection.
Now, that was when it just started. We literally got him on as it had been announced, didn't we? So there wasn't many details about it, apart from there's a picture of the old crew back together, about to start working it, but we've got our first trailer.
Oh my God, yes. Right, I'm going to get Command and Conquer.
Go on, Ravi.
Literally just mentioned it. Like, I sent it over as a news story to Dan, and like Ravi was just like, oh my God, when we walked into the studio.
So what happened with Command and Conquer? EA basically kept trying to release it. Generals was the last one, and Generals 2 was going to come out, but never came out.
Yeah.
So what happened was the fans were like, this series is blooming good. We can't leave it to die. Mm. So they started to do their own super enhanced versions. So Generals Enhanced was high res.
Okay.
It was all in like 4K, new effects. They'd redone all the things. So I think EA must have taken notice of this.
Yeah.
And they said, right, let's get the original team back and the original guys and let's do the collection. So this isn't only Command and Conquer. This is also Tiberian Sun as well. And
Red Alert.
All of the add-ons as Aftershock, all of that stuff. But they've got so many cool features. Like, a great thing about Command & Conquer was the actors in there, if you remember the video sequences.
We're talking about Gemma Atkinson.
But
she was in Red Alert 3.
But they've brought them all, they've brought loads of the actors back, haven't they?
Well, it looks like they've brought them back, but they've also upscaled the FMV. They've kind of redone the CGI, because you used to get these, like, tanks coming in, but they look awful,
like something out of the original Worms for PlayStation and PC
on the Cybercar.
Key is they've got Frank Kaplacki on, who did that fantastic music, but he's also got his new band, the Tiberian Sons, and they're also doing the real heavy metal soundtrack, and they've built in a jukebox so you can actually go through, check all the different things.
What I think really is really cool as well is they're doing it's the 25-year anniversary of it as well. And I read somewhere you can get a big box PC version of it as well. Mm. I don't know what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's how games are sold back then.
Loads of maps and like little Tiberium crystals.
Yeah, yeah. And then probably just the code for the digital game.
But, you know, they've got essential features that people have always wanted for a long time, because I know a lot of people that play Command & Conquer competitively, and custom hotkeys is a thing that they've really wanted. Yeah. You know, control improvements. I'm sure the AI is actually massively improved from the AI that they had back then, and they've got game lobbies. It's just like beautifully done and really, really for the fans.
What about, you know, the trailer then? So you've watched the trailer. I mean, are you hyped after watching
it? Oh, mega, mega, mega.
You were anyway. And it's going to be coming out in June?
June 5th.
June, we haven't got long to wait then.
Yeah, yeah, so not long.
I think pre-orders on Steam.
Yeah, so you can pre-order on Steam and Origin.
And okay, you can get a big limited edition box set as well if you want to pre-order that. Yeah,
we're thinking PC only.
It's only like, I think it's PC only, but it's only $20 from what I saw, unless I was looking at the wrong thing. Which makes sense because it's a remaster. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and sometimes these remasters and stuff come out cheap. It's not a remake. But yeah, 100%. I mean, I've not got a PC set up for gaming at the moment. So if it doesn't come to PS4 and Xbox One, I'm going to be really, really
well,
jealous.
I think if this is successful, then it's going to give a big reason for EA to relaunch Command & Conquer and probably do a more modern Command & Conquer, which would be awesome.
Yeah.
The fact they've got the original crew back together to do it, though, as well. I mean, if you're going to want to do it right, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than when, you know, we often have developers on who've worked on games in the past that have been brought back, but they've had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, yeah, I played it, but I wouldn't have done it like that.
Yeah.
And you want the original guys there that came up with the concept and have their ideas. And so, yeah, I was never, you know, I remember seeing the original game around. I was never a player of it, but I'm quite interested to get this. And
for me, after Dune, that was the best RTS. And if that had come out on the Commodore or something on the Amiga, it would have made it. But for me, I was just played it on the PC, chucked the Amiga away. You
know? is that what did it? Is it?
Yeah, that was what did it.
It was the mid-90s. I needed to upgrade.
You can't hold it off forever. So, yeah, we're excited for that. We'll keep an eye on that one. And Ravi will give you his review, I'm sure, on day one.
Yeah,
as soon as it comes out. Now, do you want about a heartwarming story? We've had lots of news that's been, you know, a bit down in the dumps over the last week. Everyone's been a bit fed up. What about something to put a smile on your face? Now, this is Nintendo.
Yeah.
Now, normally when we talk about Nintendo, it's like they took down another YouTube channel or they blocked another fan project. What about a heartwarming tale of Nintendo helping out a sweet old grandma?
Oh,
now
that's
this is
nice.
A lovely old lady, 95-year-old grandmother, lived in Japan, and she was really into Tetris on the original Game Boy. She got it when it was a new system, and then when she got to 95 years old, her health had started to decline a little bit, and then she was really upset when her Game Boy stopped working. And then her daughter tried to go and get her a replacement Game Boy. Now, you know, it can be a bit hit and miss walking around secondhand markets, that kind of thing. You've been to Japan. There are some pretty amazing gaming markets out there.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, if you want the same model, you know, grandma might have got used to the controls, doesn't want an Advance or something like that. But she couldn't actually find a good condition original Game Boy with Tetris when she was looking for one. So she decided instead that she'd write a letter to Nintendo to see if they could repair the original Game Boy. So they had a look at it. Turned out that it was damaged beyond repair. They couldn't do anything with it. But they actually found an original Game Boy still in their warehouse.
And they sent it to them.
And they sent it to them for free.
That's amazing, isn't it?
So Granny could continue to play Tetris.
That is amazing. Yeah. And what I really like as well is like the letter is, obviously it's all in Japanese and stuff, but it's good to see that they actually read it.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, usually these things are just like thrown to one side, you know what I mean? Like, or it just goes to an office somewhere and it's never looked at. So it's really nice to see that they actually went above and beyond, I guess.
I think it's maybe even that Japanese kind of thing of respecting elders.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and yeah, that's a really nice move of them to do.
And I love as well that Nintendo still got new Game Boys in the warehouse.
Where is that warehouse? Let's go find it.
Yeah, I need one. Now, we could be actually holding on to our systems for a bit longer in the future due to some new rules that apparently mean that it could be the end of throwaway culture in the UK. Is this right?
We're getting new rules from the European Commission, and even after Brexit in the UK, this is going to still count.
Right.
And what it is it's a project, and it's all about the kind of right to repair. So I don't know if you've started to hear about these movements at the moment, which are, you know, companies trying to stop people repairing stuff.
Apple.
Or having computers that go out of date really quickly.
Apple.
Or hardware that kind of breaks. Well, what they want to do is they want to make get rid of this permanent obsolescence, which is happening. And they want to create hardware that is actually replaceable, that you can repair at home. And that's going to cut down on stuff like waste.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to cut down on the amount of materials that are needed in the world to actually produce these things.
Well, you know what's really interesting about this? And you mentioned a moment ago in the last story about how I've been to Japan.
Yeah.
When I was in Japan, I've got a friend over there who we met up with, but me and my wife went around the markets and stuff, and not far from a lot of the gaming markets and stuff, there was like, you know, proper market stalls, not like shops, like selling loads of gadgets and tech and stuff like that. And there was like loads and loads and loads of like repair shops, but for your old phones, like the phones that you have on the wall with a cable and everything, and like fax machines.
Landlines.
Yeah, landlines and fax machines and stuff. And I was like, what's that all about? And there were so many like parts for them as well for sale. And like old school, really old school vacuum cleaners and, you know, just real 80s and 90s tech. So I asked my friend who's lived out there for like 3 years now. And he was just like, yeah, if they don't get rid of their stuff, like they just fix it because it's working and it's reliable. So I don't know what the crack is with Japan and how they do things and stuff. But it's really interesting that like it sounds similar, and I think like that is something we should be doing in the UK.
Well, it's stuff like, you know, you used to get laptops and they'd have like sealed in RAM.
Yeah,
you wouldn't be able to upgrade that, or even your phone battery.
Mm.
You wouldn't be able to actually take it out and replace the battery, you know. And that really needs to change, and hopefully this law is going to come in and change it. And you know, they're saying worldwide citizens repair shops are kind of popping up. It's going to be a thing that gets back to the consumers so they can actually have control over their products. I think it's really good.
We've already seen it in recent years. I mean, Apple recently got, you know, I think they got fined, didn't they, for intentionally slowing down older
iPhones.
$1.5 billion
or something like that, wasn't it?
And that, you know, was a positive move, that the fact that, you know, they were intentionally slowing down these old devices. We've got this upgrade culture where who'd have thought, you know, like 10, 15 years ago, that we'd all be happy paying a grand every 2 years for a new mobile.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Who's that guy on YouTube who goes around in Japan and builds a whole iPhone out of all the tiny parts?
Oh, I've seen that.
And there's another guy I watch in America, he runs like an Apple repair shop.
Strange Things, that's what he's called.
And it's like, he shows you like all the tricks they do to make it non-user repairable and stuff.
Really?
And that really frustrates me. It's like, you know, I do like Apple products, you know, disclaimer, I've got an Apple Watch and AirPods and everything. But then I look at them and I think, already I've had my AirPods maybe a year and a half and they're already like not getting me through a full day. No way to change the batteries in them.
Yeah.
Send my watch, you know, if I'm not getting a full day, I need to buy a new one.
Yeah.
They don't make them replaceable. So I get comments on YouTube as well of some people, which is like remarkable. Even if I'm maybe showing like, I don't know, like a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360 device, people will be like, what are you still using that crap for? Upgrade to like Xbox One's out now. There is such a culture of like, has to be the latest all the time.
But then you have your Atari 8-bit, you just change the capacitors in there and it's working again, you know, another 12 years. It's crazy.
Well, I think that is why there are so many, you know, retro gaming systems. We've still got Commodore 64s and stuff running at home. I don't think my Apple MacBook Pro is still going to be working in like 10 years, let alone 20, 30, you know what I mean? So I think that is definitely a positive move. We can keep on to our products a little bit longer. Now, actually speaking of, if you do want to replace your old product, so if it's broken, you can now get a Commodore 64 replica PCB, so the motherboard, without any of the components on there, for $35.
Yeah, this is absolutely crazy. It's called the 60 clone.
Nice.
And what it is it's a replica PCB. Now, this doesn't contain any of the parts. So you do get a few parts, which is the 6526 CIAs. You get the kernel, a few ROMs, a few things like that, little video adapter as well. But the main idea of this board is, if you've had any damage to your old Commodore 64 board or any breakages, then you can take all your components out and then put them on this new board. Or you can replace the parts with modern alternatives as well.
And that's going to last another 30 years if you get one of these. And I mean, they're all often like replacement parts that you can buy now as well. You could essentially, I mean, I've seen people, Retro Man Cave did a video, didn't he? Essentially building like a new Amiga just out of all new parts.
Yeah, and this is going to be a lot cheaper than getting one of your new C64 minis.
Mm.
If you just get an old one, take all the components off, resold them onto this new board, it's going to last a long time, you know.
As long as you know which end to hold a soldering iron, which Joe's like, what?
Thanks.
I do like it when they do come up with stuff like this. I mean, there are actually a few like guys we know, we've seen them, we went to the Amiga show in Germany. You walked around a lot of the stores there, and a lot of people have done like, essentially reverse engineered these old machines and made their own versions of it. And then you see, like, you know, the guys that actually made the original walking around looking at it going, I like what you've done there.
You've added a new exciting feature.
So, you know, it's way beyond my my skill level to do anything like that, but I do think it's very cool. Another cool little project that Joe sent me over is, you know, we've been talking that we really want a new Nintendo 64, whether that be like a handheld or a mini version. Someone got sick of waiting for Nintendo, and he's done it himself.
Yeah, so this is a YouTuber called Smacked Sam, who's like 3D printed his own portable N64, which he's made, and it looks really bizarre, which I think is like, it needs to, because it's N64.
That controller,
but it's really cool. But he's got footage here of it like up and running, playing, and apparently it can play all N64 games. because it does actually have the expansion pack included into it, built into it. And it runs the cartridges, its original hardware. So you plug it into the back. It essentially looks like a big Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I was going to say it's got their Game Boy Advance
kind of with the Nintendo 64 logo plonked, you know, on the bottom of it. And then it's just a bit wider and a bit taller and stuff. But yeah, apparently it plays, it runs it perfectly. So
this looks crazy. Really, really nice little job he's done.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously it's, you know, just the one he'll probably get a cease and desist from, you know, from Nintendo before now, this episode even goes out.
If he was a grandma...
It'd be all right.
Get your grandma to make it. Yeah.
But yeah, really, really, really cool. Really interesting. Just that, you know, he's got GoldenEye running on it. He's got Mario 64 running on it. I would like to see Donkey Kong 64 and Zelda Majora's Mask for proof of the expansion pack, but apparently it's in there.
All he needs now is a rumble pack in it.
Yeah. That'd be amazing.
It would rattle it to bits looking at it, I imagine. You know what would be cool, though, if you could have like a Link kind of cables. You know, you used to play your Game Boy Link. That'd be awesome. Like GoldenEye.
There's not much information on what he's done. I'm wondering if he's ripped an N64 apart and then put it in the 3D.
I wouldn't think the motherboard would fit in there. That's got to be emulation somewhere.
Yeah, maybe.
But then how's it reading the cart, you know?
Yeah. There are ways of doing that, I guess. You just got
a dump or something.
Yeah, it's cool, though.
Yeah, I'll definitely check out a few more. I mean, apparently he's on about putting the design up for sale, so people might be able to make their own, which is quite interesting. So that's when you attract Nintendo's attention. But I do love seeing little fan projects like that. It's really cool. Now, before we get into our guests this week, of course, we do appreciate, you know, times are a bit hard for people at the moment, but we do have a Patreon running right now, which we've been blown away by your support over the last couple of weeks on this. Now, the reason we set it up is, a little recap, because I know we do have, like, new listeners. We record our show in a studio, which, you know, a lot of people do kind of compliment us on the audio quality of our show, which is something we've always prided ourselves on. The fact that we do it in a proper broadcast studio, but we don't own the studio. And that's one of the reasons that we're in here, like, you know, at nearly 10 o'clock at night. We have to work around a schedule. We can only get in here for a few hours a week. Often we have guests that we have to try and, oh, we can't do that time. Can you do that time? You know, we go back and forth with them for like weeks trying to arrange a time when we can get in the studio to record it. So we came up with an idea that we want to get around that by building our own podcasting studio. And that would mean not only can we come in 24 hours a day, whenever we want, we can get guests on. You know, you could come in at 3 o'clock in the morning if it was our studio and record it.
Exactly. It kind of frees us up, but also, like, you know, you're going to get something for that, which is an ad-free episode of the podcast. You may even get that delivered early, depending on when we record it.
I've released a few episodes, actually, up to 2 or 3 days early to patrons.
Yeah, and...
I didn't know that.
We're going to be releasing certain extra stuff, like a little documentary we were
which
working
should be out
on.
By now, actually, yeah. On our Patreon feed, I believe. So yeah, it's the thing. We've got a few little bonuses there. And really, I mean, we're asking for your guys' support, which we appreciate. If you can't do it now, maybe in a couple of months' time, that's fine. We're in a major rush, but we're kind of an aim of doing it around the summer, hopefully.
Yeah, once all this stuff's over, then we'll try to get the studio up and running, you know.
But thanks to you guys, we're already well on our way to doing it. I mean, obviously, we're going to need like money like for deposits. Then we need to build the studio, soundproof it all and everything. I bought all the equipment. I mean, I paid about £5,000 the microphones and the mixer and the mic processors and everything. So we've got all the stuff, we just need the space. And of course, for backing us on Patreon, you will get a mention in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And you can tell all your friends, you can share on your social media. I help these guys get that studio. I help keep the Retro Hour podcast going. And we'll keep bringing out the show every Friday, thanks to your support. And for doing it, you'll get a mention in the Hall of Fame. Like this week, thank you so much to David Hall.
Richard Nicholas.
Peter Lingback.
Danny McDermott.
And Ollie J,
who all made donations into the running of the show. And if you'd like to do the same, you'll find all that in our show notes. You can get them on your podcast clients. Have a little look in there. Or we've got links on the front page of our website at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our chat this week, talking about some classic Commodore 64 games with the amazing Carlton Henley, let's do our retro picks. Now, this is where every week we kind of talk about something that might be a little website or a YouTube video or a game that we've been playing, just something that's interested us personally in the world of retro gaming. Now, this week, I want to give a mention to our good friend, Stephen Fletcher. Now, we all see Steve at shows. I love Steve.
Yeah, Steve's a lovely guy, and he's a documentary maker as well. And what he's actually produced before was The Commodore Story, which was an absolutely fantastic documentary all about Commodore, but also going into the Amiga, which was like Commodore's later machines.
And he went all around the world. You know, he went to Leonard Tramiel's house, who was Jack Tramiel's son. Did an interview at his house with him. You know, no expenses spared in it. He put so much effort into it. You know, I think it took him a good couple of years to do all the filming of it. And now, we were chatting to him at an Amiga show last year, and he said, the Amiga scene is so vibrant, I think it deserves a new movie about the Amiga in 2020. So he's doing it all again. He's going back around the world, and this time he's meeting fans, and he's meeting people that are making new hardware for classic systems and recreations and upgrades and that kind of thing. And this is called the Amiga 2020 documentary. Now, it's running on Kickstarter at the moment, and it did actually smash the goal in around 24 hours.
Yeah, he's just even smashed it further, and he's doing very well at the moment.
There's a couple of weeks left, but obviously, I mean, that's the thing about Kickstarters. You get to the point where the goal is, that doesn't mean that's all you need. That means he's literally got just enough to make it. So anything extra you get over that is going to make the documentary even better, allow him to do more and interview more people around the world. So if you'd like to back it, I mean, I'm sure anyone that watched the Commodore story will be really familiar with how good Steve's work is. And little disclaimer, we're both in it, me and you, Ravi. I was literally just scrolling
through the Kickstarter, and when you get to the contributors section, the first person mentioned is Ravi.
I'm going to be doing some hosting and kind of helping tell the story of Amiga,
like a voiceover.
2020. Yeah, kind of just like keeping it narration or something like that. Yeah,
and I'm in the trailer. Little disclaimer: it was at Amiga Germany. I think I went to bed at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he filmed this at 9 o'clock.
You're always hungover in these things.
He always wants to film me on a Sunday morning at a show. So, yeah, that's why you probably I've got bags under my eyes, bigger than my suitcase that was behind me, I think, at the time. But it's going to be an incredible movie, and it's great to see that people are supporting it. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to back that as well. What have you been checking out this week, Joe?
So, a YouTuber. I've been checking out, been watching some of his videos recently. I've been following him for a while. But a guy called Gilly the Kid, who I really like him. He's just like, he doesn't put an act on. Yeah. He doesn't like mess about or anything like that. He's just straight. Do you know what I mean? And he's not like particularly angry or particularly excitable. He's just entertaining, and he's just got a good voice to listen to.
And he looks like you.
He does look a little bit like me. He's probably actually a little bit better looking than me.
I didn't want to say. Of course not, handsome Joe.
Thank you.
No one's more handsome than Joe.
But yeah, I just wanted to give him a shout out. Been watching a lot of his videos recently. And, you know, he covers all genres of gaming. And, you know, he kind of covers a lot of 80s, a lot of 90s, a lot of 2000s.
A lot of Game Boy stuff as well, isn't
it? A lot of Game Boy Advance. You know, and he does a lot of, like, you know, he goes on Switch. Yeah. On the Switch eStore, on the store, and he'll just like buy like 10 games for a dollar each and just review them. And he's just so straight talking. You know, he'll just be like, this game is awful. Like, he's not bothered, you know.
No holds barred.
But he's not like angry and over the top. So it's just nice to watch.
Gilly the Kid. You've been checking out a website then. It's a website that's been around for a while.
Yeah, so this is the fantastic lemonamiga.com. Now, this site is totally about Amiga computers, and we make no kind of
no qualms about the fact that
we absolutely
you
love,
don't hide it
love Amiga. Yeah,
we're not closet,
and this not closet Amigans, no. And this site is absolutely fantastic because it lists pretty much every game that's ever come out on the Amiga, and it has it in different systems, so you can find out the details. And you do not know how useful this has been for reviews for the Retro Hour, because you get individual people's little comments and reviews about the game, and it gives you a really good picture of the game. But also, they have a really cool little tool. It's in an area called Lemonade, and it's the game file scanner. What it will actually do is it will scan your whole hard drive for ADF files, and even if they're hidden inside zip folders, it will find them and list them. So you get an accurate picture of the actual Amiga titles that you've got in your system.
I do love the fact they have all the links to the manuals and the cheats as well.
Yeah, and it's beautifully done as well. It's all in pixel art. It's like just really nice site, one of my favourite ones.
Someone the other day, actually, I saw them talking about Lemon Amiga, and I think they put a link to, like, you know, it was like YouTube in 2006. YouTube today looks totally different. Lemon Amiga in 2006, and it hasn't changed. Yeah. Literally the same design. But again, like you're saying before, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
So exactly.
It looks good. So if you want to check out our picks, that and everything else we talked about will be in this week's show notes at theretrohour.com. Right now, let's get our Commodore 64 on with this week's special guest, Carlton Henley.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Going to get some stories about brilliant games on the Commodore 64 in particular back in the day. Let's welcome on Carlton Hanley. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you joining us. Now, before we get into the games and stuff that you worked on back in the day and the projects that you're doing now, because I know you're quite back into retro at the moment, let's kind of wind things right back to the beginning. I mean, what kind of first got you into video games or computers back in the day?
I had an older brother. He was about 4 years older than me, and this was the late, not a bit of late 70s, and he got a one of those little Pong machines you have. You remember those, the Benetons?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he got one of them, and we used to play that together and just got really into games from then. He ended up getting new computers, and eventually I think I took over from him getting a Commodore in 84. You know, the old trick your dad into thinking it's for your homework.
So those kind of Benetton machines, they were like just a couple of choices, didn't you have? Was it amazing when you went onto the Commodore and kind of realised there was a huge selection of games?
Yes, yeah, I mean, yeah, it was totally different. I mean, it wasn't even colour, that. I mean, I'm not so sure we even had a colour TV, though, when I got my Commodore, to be honest. We weren't allowed to use the front room TV. But, yeah, we couldn't afford the games, though, obviously. I think my Commodore came with International Soccer on cartridge, and my brother had saved up some money, and we bought Daily Thomas's Decathlon, I think, was the first game.
A joystick destroyer, wasn't it?
Well, we genuinely did a bit. Our Commodore came with a Commodore joystick, which was a bit of a rip-off of the old Atari joysticks, and we snapped it in half in about the second day, I think, which was a bit of a disaster. But luckily, we could use our old Atari joysticks. I did have I did have an Atari in between that, a VCS, so we had some selection of games, but again, I think they were £30 even then, the game, so it was once a Christmas, one game per Christmas time deal.
Well, how did you actually get into programming then, like, from becoming a player to a creator?
We had a friend, and he could program. He was writing things in BASIC, and he'd written this game called Monster Manager. It was a bit like Football Manager, but with monsters. If there could be such, you can imagine such thing. And I was like, oh, you know, how do you do that? You know, you don't consider. I don't think I'd ever considered that you could actually program these things. And he had an assembler program that he lent me. And I just took it from there. Yeah, this is quite interesting to me to get behind the scenes. Quite difficult as well.
Was it mainly like assembler? Did you go straight in with machine code then, or did you learn in BASIC first?
No, straight to machine code.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that same thing, you know. But 6502 is pretty limited, and Commodore BASIC is pretty awful. So I wouldn't advise anyone to learn from Commodore BASIC.
Yeah, it was all peaks and pokes.
Well, exactly, that's it. So that's how machine code is. It's the same thing. It's peak and pokes and memory about, and thing is, you might as well go straight to the hub of it. And like I say, I'd given me this assembler, so that was what piqued my interest rather than actually writing in BASIC.
Were there many like software labels or programmers that you were particularly a fan of?
Yeah, Braybrook. Yeah. You know, the usuals, really. Braybrook, Marjorie McLean, Jeff Crammond. There were more than programmers, a lot of them, weren't they, as well? There was some I'd never managed to achieve. You know, a lot of them did all the graphics, all the design, sort of incredible people. I've not got any of those other talents, sadly.
Yeah, you're right, because back then a lot of them were kind of in a lot of games, or like a one-man kind of band, weren't they? You know, or bedroom coders even.
Yeah, I mean, it's still happening a bit these days with, you know, a lot of the indie stuff. You know, these one-man bands have been making incredible things, and, you know, Jonathan Blow and them making so creative and yet such talented programmers and artists. It's a little bit weird to me.
Well, let's talk about the arcades as well. I mean, obviously, that was kind of peak arcade era. Were you much of an arcade goer? Is there any games that you made like a beeline for?
We used to go to Blackpool when we could. We obviously didn't have enough money to pl- playing much, but we'd watch the track modes. But the big ones I remember, I was probably slightly older when I had a little bit more money, maybe like Operation Wolf and Power Drift, Space Area Scene, those sort of things. You know, again, that was like seeing the Commodore from the Atari. I think just a massive step change in what video games could be. Not so great on the gameplay, though, I don't think. No, some of those. Yeah. Now you look back, sadly, you know, all show and not much. We've got an arcade club here, very near my house, sadly just close to there, for the foreseeable future, but to see all those old machines again, it still gives me a thrill.
Oh, it's a fantastic place, yeah.
Yeah, have you been? Yeah, it's an incredible place. Actually, I didn't know when I went. He was a trainee with me for 2 weeks at Walking Circles as a trainee Commodore programmer.
Oh, is this Andy runs Arcade Club?
Yes, Andy.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so he's obviously it's nearby because Arcade Club's in there. Yeah, and he came and he wanted to try programming and we gave him a job, but didn't quite work out, but, you know, he's had the last laugh, I think.
Yeah, small world.
yeah, it was odd. He remembered me. He's got, apparently he's got a lot of my old source code discs and things that I thought were lost in time. He's such a collector.
Yeah.
He's got sort of all sorts of random stuff like that, and he just keeps inviting me to go around and go through it, but you never find the time, do you?
That's awesome that he's kept it all.
So
what was really special about the C64, and why did you kind of prefer it over other 8-bits?
Yeah, well, I mean, I like both 8-bit machines. Well, the Spectrum. We'd swap with friends. I'd have a Spectrum for a weekend. He'd have my Commodore. He'd want to play Exploding Fist and things like that. I'd want to play Wheelie. But the Commodore games were more my wheelhouse with Brave Books games, the fast action stuff, Drop Zone. That's the stuff. And Pit Stop 2. There was nothing like that on the Spectrum for me. I don't remember. It was only the Ultimate games you were jealous of, I think, as a Commodore owner.
Well, let's talk about the games that you made. I mean, Spitting Image was your first release game, if I'm correct. And obviously that was a big TV show that was on then. It was a very high-profile release. How did you get, like, such a high-profile title for, like, your first release game then?
Walking Circles was a tiny company. There were six of us, really, at Walking Circles. Someone did the Amstrad and Spectrum versions and stuff. But they never did Commodore 64 games before I joined. But they'd done a lot of work for Dormart. They did Living Daylights and Cat Trap. Do you remember the Design a Game competition in
yeah.
Crash Magazine?
Yeah, yeah.
Cat Trap. Oddly, Cat Trap, what Million Molly's based on, but same there, not that game. So they'd done a lot of that. And then, so Dormart basically hired us. I think four of my five games at the Walking Circles were for Dormart, and Spitting Image just happened to be the first one. It wasn't actually the first game I did at Walking Circles, though. It was the first released. But I did a game called Wanderer for Elite Systems, what they call. But they didn't release that until after Spitting Image came out. It was quite odd to be working on something so famous. I think I was probably 16 at the time.
If our American listeners don't know, Spitting Image is a satirical puppet show.
Yep.
And it was a huge cultural shift. It was absolutely massive. Did you manage to talk to any of the staff, Chris Barry, any of the guys that did the voices, or did they have any input on the game?
We didn't work with the people who did the thing, but we did work with the writers, and Jeff Atkinson, who was a big comedy writer at the time, I think he was chief writer on that, did write the game spec such as it was, and there's an intro and a storyline in the game that they wrote and provided us, and that formed the basis for the game.
And did they have a chicken song and C64 version?
I think chicken song came out just after we'd finished. Otherwise, we'd definitely done it. But David Whittaker did a good version of the actual main TV theme anyway. So,
well, when the game came out, I mean, having such a high profile title like that, I imagine there was a quite a big promotion run. I mean, did you have to do much to promote the game? Were you like going out and visiting magazines and that kind of thing? And what happened?
We did go to Crash Magazine. We took a drive out to Ludlow. I was properly fanboying when we went there. I was expecting this big tower. I think you used to call it Zap Towers, and I thought it's going to be this big fancy thing. And it was a tiny little scruffy office above an estate agent in Ludlow. I think I've said this before. They completed the Spectrum version on the first go. The reviewers were there promoting it. It was pretty mortifying.
How long did it take them?
Well, I think 10 minutes maybe of button mashing and I think we went back and actually changed it a little bit to try and improve it after that. But, well, we were just more jealous. They actually won a competition at the time, in, I think it was in Zap, and crashed, that you could win a puppet made if you did it. And I don't know who's got that. Someone did win the competition, and it was like thousands of pounds worth of prize. But, yeah, they got to go to the actual place where they made the puppets and... And get a puppet made of yourself.
That's awesome.
We weren't offered that.
I mean, you mentioned that about, you know, visiting the magazine and stuff, and I was looking through a few of the reviews before we started recording, and I mean, you know, it didn't get great ratings. I think The One gave it 34%. Crash gave it 65% as well. I mean, was that kind of a bit disappointing for your first release game?
I think we knew it wasn't great, and reviews back then were much more honest, yeah. I think, than they are now. You know, so I think we were probably expecting that. I think the Commodore version did much worse than what you're saying now. I think Zap gave it less than 40%. And in fact, Wanderer, which I was talking about before, got 16% in Crash. So my first two games, barely scraped 50% between them. It was a bad start, I would say. I'd lucky to keep a job, I think.
I remember, you know, reading about Walking Circles, and I think, you know, if I remember rightly, they kind of did they go out of business in the early 90s, I want to say. They're around for a few years, I remember, but again, they're not really a company that you read much about, and like looking online for them, there's not really much about them anymore. And I'm quite curious just to find out a bit more about the company itself, and what was it like working there, and what was the team like, and any memories of it that stand out?
Well, it was a great place, you know, like I said, you know, I mean, I was at school and, you know, dreaming of getting a job in video games, not thinking it was even slightly possible. And then turns out there's this little company very near where I lived, and I went along on it was a youth training scheme run by the government here, and I got the job because I guess I was local and I could program a little bit. But it was actually it was the remnants of a company called Design, who were much sort of more well-respected, I think, on the spectrum. They did Dark Star and Hall of Things and stuff like that. So once they stopped publishing and a couple of people left, what was left became Walking Circles, and we're just a development house instead. But, yeah, it was a great place. Graham Stafford taught me everything, you know, supported me really well. Like I said, I was very young at the time. I can't pretend that it was all my own work.
So the British video games industry and computer games industry at the time, I mean, when we're getting into the late 80s, it did seem like a very exciting place to be. I mean, did you kind of have much to do with other companies, and were you quite ingrained in the industry? How did you find it?
Yeah, a bit. Possibly not so much in my Commodore days. We were a little bit isolated, but certainly Manchester, going into the 90s and stuff, Manchester was a hotbed of a lot of companies, Creations and Tertex and that. So when I started working at Tertex and stuff, we started mingling with a lot more people because we'd all go out into Manchester and stuff. Yeah, and it was a great time. You know, we were young people with reasonable disposable income and things like that. And it was hardly the Wolf of Wall Street, but, you know, it was a lot better than a lot of my friends were doing.
What was the story with Wanderer, and what inspired that?
it was a QL game. Do you remember that?
Sinclair QL.
So I think it was a QL game, and it had this gimmick with real 3D, if you wore the purple and green glasses. And Steve Wilcox at Elite had seen it at a trade show, bought up the rights immediately, and then wanted a conversion. We did it totally unsuitable for a Commodore 64, and the 3D didn't really work on a Spectrum because Spectrum colours were hardly great. And the game itself wasn't particularly good. So, yeah, we finished it. I don't know whether Steve Wilcox had suddenly realised that it wasn't that good a game to start with. The conversions were passable.
The QL was an interesting platform as well, because that was kind of like Sinclair's business machine, wasn't it?
Yeah, there were loads of computers coming out around then, weren't there? That, you know, everyone was giving it a go, Dragons and Einsteins, and it was a weird time, but, you know, no one was supporting them. I think Design supported the Dragon quite a bit. No one at my school had one, and certainly no one bought a QL, did they?
No.
Despite Clive's advert jumping about 30 feet in the air, I think.
Yeah, it's still on YouTube, that, isn't it? It's a funny advert.
Oh, I'll have to look. I think I'm just remembering it.
Oh, you also did a C64 version of All Points Bulletin from Atari. It's kind of like an above-view GTA-style game from the police perspective. Do you remember doing that? And do you remember anything specific about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's my finest. From back in the day, that was the finest thing we did. Again, it was for Dormark. They'd got the Tengen license. We were going to do either that or tubing. And I remember going to an arcade with some friends to have a look at both of them. And I was saying, I hope we get that 2 minutes. and simpler game to write, but we got APB. But it was quite challenging. Again, Graham led the programming on that, on the Spectrum. And we did some sort of crazy things we probably shouldn't have, like put the full map in. So it's a huge map. It's 32K uncompressed. So it decompresses in real time as you're driving about in strips, which is why it doesn't run at what everyone wanted on the Commodore back in the day, 50 hertz and stuff. But we never had QA people. I never saw QA or designers or anything until even after Tertex. So we released that game, and I've since found out that if you get past day 16, I think it just crashes.
All right.
because we didn't have any data for any more days, and we didn't think to put a game ending in, or, you know, we'd never finished the arcade machine.
Probably too hard to get there anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember. Yeah, no one would have got there. I mean, it might be in 32 days, so yeah, but yeah, it's too hard. It's too hard a game. There's certain things we couldn't put into the 8-bit versions that helps the gameplay a bit. Like there were, like the arcade machine puts barriers up on some of the road to guide you to where the APBs are, but we didn't do that, so you could just drive about randomly. It was more like an open world driving game in the end.
Yeah, very, very, and it scored really well in reviews as well, didn't it?
Yeah, so it was my only Zap Sizzler, and got an Oli Frey front cover. I got in touch with him recently, because you can buy the print. Well, you can buy prints or the original artwork, but it's been lost, the APB cover. So yeah, so there's not even a print version of it. So yeah.
Well, speaking of things that have been lost, I mean, I was reading before on Games That Weren't, which is a website all about like video games that never actually got released in the end. There's a game that you worked on called Behemoth. What was kind of the story with that game then?
Well, this was, like I said, we weren't getting any contract work in because Commodore 64 stuff was fading out. We were doing some Amiga bits, but again, not really anything that was contracted to us, so we were just trying to make something to sell to companies. Someone else took over an Amiga game. I think we were doing Lemmings part on Amstrad, and then it was like, I was the Commodore programmer, let's copy Armalite and see if we can sell it to one of the budget companies just to tick us over. But by the time we got anything near sellable, we weren't getting any bites, and then that's when about the time the company closed, I think.
Have you still got any copies of it, like the source code or anything, or...?
I found the source code and I actually converted it to a modern, to a PC compiler nowadays. So is it not on Games.Weren't? I think you can still maybe download. I managed to make a PRG of it, and I think you can run it in an emulator.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay. I'll have to have a look at that again.
Like I say, it's no Armalite for sure, but it could have been better had we developed it further.
Well, I mean, you did keep doing Commodore 64 games for a while. There's another one, Skull and Crossbones, that was like a pirate fighting game. Do you remember much about that?
Yeah, that was another of the Tengen ones after APB. We got sent that. We used to get the arcade machines in the office. That was probably the funnest part of it, because APB arcade machine was quite good. We did Hard Driving as well. Not the sequel to Hard Driving. That was the best machine we ever had in the office. Me and my friends used to go down. Like I said, still at the time, I was only 17 or 18, so we'd actually go in on the bus on a Saturday just to play the arcade cabs in the office. But Skull and Crossbones wasn't one of them, and I'm not so sure the arcade cab even came out in the UK. But yeah, it was a very poor, badly remembered Atari. Yeah, I think we did an alright conversion of it for what it was, but...
Having an arcade machine in the office, that must have been quite a distraction when you had to sit there.
It wasn't in the old office. We used to have a separate room, so they were a bit out of sight, out of mind. But yeah, when we moved to the newer offices, it was all in one room, and yeah, we'd spend too much time. Like I said, especially stunt driving, was that the follow-up to Hard Driving? Stunt driving, we used to be brilliant at it though. You could go into it, you see these people in arcades who are really good.
I've never been one of them.
Because we effectively would have cost us about £300 in 10p's to get to the level we were at, just playing each other and trying to beat the ghost driver and things.
So I assume it was free to play. You weren't using your wages.
No, we didn't have. No, we wouldn't have been able to spend £300 if we spent our wages from back then. That's for sure.
Well, yeah. When the 16-bit platform started to take off, did you see a sharp decline in C64 work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was what brought the end of Walking Circles. Really, we did do some Amiga parts. I never did any of the actual official contracted work. I wrote games that weren't. I think I wrote a prototype called Bloodline, which was based on an old design game called Horrible Things. So it had procedurally generated levels, and the enemies looked a bit like paranoid-y types. So it was working all right, but again, we couldn't sell it to be able to fund enough to develop it beyond what was effectively a prototype.
How long had you worked there at that stage, Angus? It must have been quite sad, you know, after being there for a few years, the kind of decline of the company.
Yeah, I think I thought it was a job for life, you know, because like I say, it was my first job, and it was like, oh, this is it, I'm going to be writing Commodore 64 games for the rest of my life. But I think I'd have been there 87, five years maybe. It seems a long time now to say I only did 5 published games, I think. That seems a long time, because that's not the amount of time it took to develop a game back in the day. You know, APB probably took 4 or 5 months maximum, then that was the longest one we did, I think.
You're always playing arcades. That's what took us.
Possibly, yeah. Playing arcades and watching Nightmare on a Friday afternoon. Oh, yeah. On Netflix, tell us what we used to do.
Yeah, I love Nightmare.
It was a great show.
Well, you worked with the Pickford brothers as well at Z2. I mean, any stories you remember from that time, and what were they like to work with?
That was a great place. I'd actually met Steve and John at Creations. We worked Software Creations. We worked together there, but they left to form Z2, and then they had some work, a project they wanted to do, and they approached me to come. They actually interviewed me in a pub in Manchester.
Nice.
I was actually driving, so I stayed sober whilst they got drunk, so I think I managed to get a couple of a few extra quid out of them on my salary.
Signed this contract.
Yeah, but then they contacted me about 2 weeks before I was due to start and said, oh, Steve's had to pull out of a trip to New York for the game we're going to do. It was called Dragon Tales, and it was by Children's Television Workshop, the Sesame Street people. Mm. It was a very popular cartoon in America. I don't think it did too well. He says, oh, so can you fill in for Steve? We've got to go for 4 days for this one meeting. I went, oh, I'll see if I can manage that. Yeah, so my first day on the job was actually in New York for Z2. Wow. And I think we went to San Francisco the year after as well for a company GDC trip. So it was a great place, but sadly I don't think we got paid by a company. I shouldn't probably not say this in my life, right? I think there was some trouble with getting paid for some work for the ET game we'd done, the batch got released, and it put too much financial pressure on us, and we were bought out by Warthog, which I didn't go along to. Moved on at that time.
Well, you also developed titles for the Sega Game Gear. What was that system like, and did it change the way that you kind of worked, working for a handheld?
It wasn't very far removed from a Commodore 64 Game Gear, really. It had better colours, but it had some oddly worse sprites and things. And you didn't really develop it as an handheld. It was, the dev kit was pretty much a Master System dev kit, but with a little screen you could plug onto this. You just had a big ugly circuit board on your desk plugged into a PC. So yeah, I don't think you didn't write stuff basing it around being handheld. It was just someone's got, I mean, barely handheld, were they? Game gears are quite big now. They're quite big by today's standards. But it was a nice little, just a, the weird thing is I wrote Game Gear versions, but we did a separate Master System version with a separate programmer. And I still to this day, I don't know why, because like I say, it's the same thing, but with a slightly smaller screen area.
Yeah, it was essentially a portable Master System, wasn't it?
But I think the screen was square and was only about 20 by 20 characters, but everything else was the same as the Master System. There's no reason really to develop 2 separate versions. I don't know what the thinking was behind that. I always think my Game Gear versions were better than the Master System versions, though.
Well, the industry moved very fast around, you know, the early to mid 90s. I mean, was it kind of hard to keep up with all the new systems that were coming along? And like, there seemed to be new hardware coming out like every 2 months at that stage.
Yeah, again, in the first 10 years of my working in the industry, I worked on loads of systems. You were just asked, you know, if someone came in, if someone came into the company and it needed developing, you were put on that. So, you know, like I said, what's on PCs, or what's on Amstrads, or what's on Amigas, STs, the SNES, I think, we're just at the end of my tier-taste time, Game Gear, like I said. Help out on the Mega Drive version. You just turn your hand to anything. It's slight, you know. You'd have the, probably a main programmer doing who's specialised, but you could certainly drop in and out of. I think my last job at Tertex was doing sound effects for Shaq Fu, was it called?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's a famous bad game, isn't it, Shaq Fu? That's, I think that's up there in the top 10, I think.
Didn't they do a newer version recently?
I think they did, actually. You're right, because I think we read about that more like, no, seriously?
Yeah. I think they had a Dennis Rodman and King John Neal in it.
Yeah, well, it's an odd one to resurrect, isn't it? Hated at the time, let's bring it back.
Yeah, they'll be doing Rise of the Robots next or something.
Rise of the Robots HD.
Yeah.
I think I worked with someone who worked on that. Did Jim Bagley work on that?
On Rise of the Robots, did he? I wasn't aware.
I might be slandering him though. Don't quote me.
Yeah, it's not on his Moby games, I don't think.
No, keep that quiet. Definitely someone. I'd have to double check that.
Well, you worked on a lot of football titles in the 90s, like FIFA and World Cup 98. That was a kind of period where FIFA started to dominate in the football games. What was it like working on those titles, and how did that come about?
Well, I did do a conversion of the very first Mega Drive FIFA. That was one of my Game Gear projects at Tertex. And then I moved to Creations. We spent 3 years getting nothing out of the door at all, working on... Failure after failure, very frustrating. And then the AI came along and needed an N64 version of the FIFAs. And like I say, it was just taking off then, but I remember them showing us a 3DO version, which was the first like full 3D one we'd seen. And it, you know, it was like, wow, you know, this is a big license, this is a big company. This is actually going to be paid work for the company, we might keep our jobs. Yeah, it was good, but that was the start of working in much bigger teams than you used to. I think, you know, even just doing the N64 version, we were getting a lot of, they called them the common modules. So they'd send the AI code and the tournament manager code, and we just basically did front end and things for the first one. But even then, we had six programmers on the N64 one at our end, and, you know, and five artists. And so suddenly this big team from almost bedroom coding for 8 years. It was a different world. I must say, I've never particularly liked working like that.
Well, also, it seemed to be a bit of a kind of tech race. So, like, each football game that came out, they were trying to outdo each other. And obviously, International Superstar Soccer came out later on. But did you have any briefs to kind of add new features in or stuff like that?
Yeah, that's what we started doing in the later one. We were never given then to actually do our own bits, but we ended up doing some of these, what I call the common modules. So we'd do tournament managers, and then they want to I think they still do it, don't they? They just bring in some incremental change each year. So we had a skill drills, I think one year was just, well, like I said, just the World Cup was the simple thing. They'd never really, I mean, it's over 20 years since I was working on them, which frightens me that they've done a sequel every year, and it's not that far different from the game it was then. The one time we did try and change it, and this people won't really remember this, is a separate standard called Premier League Stars, and it was based on the FIFA engine and stuff, but had this totally different feel where it was like almost like an RPG, so you'd build up your players and you'd get stars if you won matches, and then you could spend stars on each of your players to make them better, and like, so you could grind out a good team.
It's quite interesting, because nowadays they just seem to go for realism rather than features.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the strength of that, of FIFA, and why it beat PES in the end, was just the license, and I can play as Rooney or whatever, wasn't it? I think people don't seem to look much beyond that. Didn't seem to be happy with a new strip and a realistic looking stadium. It's a bit of a shame that the football game, I mean, I don't play online and stuff, so I don't know a lot of that stuff's about in these career modes they do.
Well, it tends to be, if somebody if you're beating someone and it goes half time, then they pull out their cord and have a rage.
We used to have rage quits in the office when we were playing FIFA. Don't worry about that. I remember there was this thing where if you got four players sent off, the match was abandoned and it was a 3-0 win. So people are trying deliberately foul if they were losing 4-0 and just
playing it online. At least you can't hit each other.
No, I'll storm out of the office. And
I think there was a great one in FIFA 95 where the referee had to actually come up to the player to give him a card. So what you could do is you could run around the whole stadium and he'd be chasing you with a card.
It was nice. I mean, I never particularly liked that original FIFA compared. I think the reason the company gave me the job was because I liked football, and Kickoff 2 was probably my most played game ever. And I still think that was better than any of the football games that followed.
Yeah, the Sensi as well obviously was huge, wasn't it?
See, I never liked Sensi. Yeah, I think it would. I was too much in the Kickoff 2 campaign. I thought they'd ripped it off and stuff, and I never quite liked. Although I've played Kickoff 2 since, and it's a little bit pinball-y and finicky. So they were probably right. The refinements in Sensi Soccer are a bit neater, but it seems a bit. It never felt as pure as to me. Especially when I played football in real life, the ball pings about like it doesn't kick off to it, doesn't stick to my feet like a Sensi.
More realistic.
Yeah, more realistic, more the way I play, falling over.
Well, I know you've done a lot of iOS games and mobile games over the last decade or so, but recently you've kind of got more into retro development as well. I mean, is that something that you've kind of stepped away from retro? Have you always kind of had like a 64 in your cupboard that you played on, or have you kind of rediscovered them in recent years?
No, like I say, I've got my arcade cabinet. I play that, and I've often toyed with emulators on the original Xbox and things. So yeah, I've always enjoyed them. And like I say, when I was working in bigger teams on games at the end, I never liked that as much. Then we got to go back to developing like one man team stuff on mobiles. I mean, I go back well beyond before iPhones. I used to do a lot on the Nokia handsets and things like that, and I enjoyed developing like that much more. I got to do things like California Games conversion for them, and you know, there was a solo programmer challenge that I like, and then for years now there's no money to be made on the iOS App Store with games, so I don't get to write them, so I've ended up, let's say, going full circle and starting writing on the Commodore again.
Yeah, so let's talk about Millie and Molly Meet Malicious Monsters then. So tell us about the game.
It's based on a Game Boy Knuckle, just a normal Game Boy game I used to play back in the day, and I bought it since on the 3DS. It's on the Virtual Console there. And it was just, I think, a very underrated and unknown puzzle game. So I was thinking about it and about how, because I can't design, I thought, I could knock a version of that out. If I took all the levels out and just wrote the game logic, I could have a game, a good version of Millie Mole. I'll stick it out for free to the community and we'll go from there. And then people got interested from prototype videos, like publishers and people were saying, and then an artist joined. And then my old friend Chun, who was the designer on the Getaway on the PS2 and stuff, and we'd worked together at Creations, got in touch and said he'd like to try and make 100 new levels. So then it became effectively its own game, and Chun's levels are much part of the success because it's been really well received, much more so than any of my actual original Commodore games from back in the day.
Does it blow your mind like how popular it all is again?
It does, yeah. It's been incredible. Like I said, even when we did all this stuff, I was gonna release it for free because I thought, you know, people are not gonna pay for a Commodore game. It's fiddly for non-collects and stuff. But then I was advised not to by someone saying, you know, there's just sort of odd piracy thing and people just put their own name on it and make it look like that. And if you sell it for a small price, the community accepts it more. So I put it out for a small price and, you know, it made far more money than I ever did on the app. So I've been able to give Chun and Saul and Hans a little bit of money back for the work they put in.
And even recently when we've had stuff like, you know, the 64 Mini and like, you know, the new Maxi release and stuff as well, it's like seeing them back in the shops and stuff. I mean, are you inspired to make any more titles for the 64 then? Or have you already started?
I've actually got a finished project, right. Which is supposed to be coming out by RGCD, but that's been delayed. I don't quite know why. I think think it just, you know, the hobbyist projects. So I think it's just getting time to actually publish it. Cytronic are doing the disc and tape version of that, but I think they're waiting for IGCD so they come together. And I also started, you see this on the YouTube channel, a sort of platform, because I wanted to do something much more technical, an actual technical game. So it's a scrolling, full colours, full screen scrolling, jumpy game. But this may be on hold because I've been actually approached by some people that may want something a bit more serious and quite a big project for the Commodore.
Wow.
Yes, so I don't know how much I'm allowed to say about it, but it's quite an interesting opportunity. So yeah, so that might be put on hold whilst they do that. But I'm trying to get a little team together to do it justice. It's a sequel to a well-loved Commodore 64 game.
But an there's official, a teaser.
an official sequel as well. No, yes, no, but like I said, I don't know whether I'm allowed to say so I shan't.
Well, when you can, we'll get you back on, because that sounds...
Well, I'm sure we'll be... if it turns out to be as big as I probably think it is, then we'll be doing the rounds trying to publicise it, I'm sure.
Fantastic. Well, Carl, it's great to have you back doing 64 production as well, and really enjoyed this little trip down memory lane with you this week, so thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for asking me. It's always a pleasure to speak about those days.